Major fighting here.
It's all over the place. Holy
abnormal. I see dead people walking around like regular people.
Paranormal. Somewhere between abnormal and paranormal.
I felt like something was near me. Kind of a eerie feeling.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Jeremy Scott asks the questions that we're all dying to know.
You can't handle the truth!
Hello? Hello?
You can't keep him down, no matter how hard you try.
Hey, that's the guy! And he's back for more!
Traveling into the witching hour from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon, somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, you're riding into the paranormal.
We survived the end of the earth. You know, it's one of those another doomsday scenarios that has come and gone, and we're all here charging forward almost into the dog days of summer, some places more so than ever. I certainly left behind some of the dog days of summer, and now I'm in a much cooler climate up here in the Pacific Northwest. I welcome you to the program. I'm Jeremy Scott, and I'm nobody special, except I just have close to 170 episodes of this genre of programming under my belt, and this genre of programming happens to be a little bit different than what you're used to on a typical talk program. If it's obviously something that the whole world is talking about, we can talk about it. And the number for you to get involved on this program is 818, not 888. 818-672-6865. That's area code 818-672-6865. You can click the Skype button as well at intotheparabnormal.wix.com/ITP radio, our website, or just search Skype for Into Parabnormal. That way you can sound really good when you call into the program, eh? Gonna have some good stuff as usual tonight as we serve up a full meal deal, Area 51 East. I know you might be asking what's that. The story of the Montauk Chronicles will be told tonight with independent filmmaker Christopher Garitano. Also, we're going to get into Bigfoot. If any of this tickles your fancy, keep that number handy, 818-672-6865. That's 818-672-6865. Or into Paranormal on Skype. Want to welcome on WLRU 106.9 FM, listening in Hillsboro, Ohio, also in the Valentine, Van Horn, Fort Davis, and Marfa, Texas area on 1610 Valentine Radio. Of course, we're going out over the TuneIn Radio app, and want to thank those of you who are continuing to follow the program on YouTube and on Spreaker and on other places that we will be going here and there in the coming weeks. Yeah, there is this prediction that while the world was going to end, it usually has something to do with religion, doesn't it not? 9 times out of 10. Well, surprise, surprise, they are wrong, because the world did not end. Actually, yesterday, the 29th, was the claim that the magnetic poles on Earth were going to flip, and that was going to wipe us all off the planet. If you believe that, I have oceanfront property here in Metro Oregon to sell you. But July 29th came and went, and we're still here to live and tell about it. So can you understand why I'm a little bit, pessimistic about all such scenarios? Because doomsday predictions, they all fail, because obviously we are still here, and it is exactly reasons like that. In paranormal news here this last Saturday in July, there is a pretty spectacular sight that happened over the western part of the United States since you and I met last time right here on Into the Paranormal at this spot and at this time. A Chinese rocket fell to the earth just a couple of nights ago, July the 27th, blazing a spectacular sky trail that left observers across parts of the western United States slack-jawed, according to space.com. There is video you can see for yourself that, quote, lit up skies over Utah, Nevada, Colorado, Idaho, and California about 9 p.m. local time. And then the fireball said to have broken up into many bright pieces. And that was it. 818-672-6865. 818-672-6865. Into Parabnormal on Twitter. Were you a witness? Do you have a thought on what these folks may have seen? Whether or not you believe in such could actually wipe out this planet or not? Speaking of, would you shoot down a fireball? I'm not exactly sure. Would you shoot down a UFO? I don't know if that's really a good idea either. But over South Africa, there is video of such a reported incident. Johannesburg, South Africa, in fact, where reportedly a fighter jet engaged and then shot down a UFO. There's about a 15-minute video that you can digest if you wish, courtesy of friends over at Inquisitor.com. The Zika virus, officials say, may be spreading in Florida by, get this, mosquitoes. Well, considering it is a mosquito-borne, a mosquito-transmitted virus, rather, that should not be surprising. A couple of weeks ago, we had information on the Zika virus. There are four recent cases in Florida that have raised the likelihood of mosquito-borne infection. This would mark the first in U.S. history. And also a very interesting story, a conspiracy theory, if you will. We entertain those from time to time here on the program. This story is also courtesy of our friends at Inquisitor.com. Out of Russia, a video that conspiracy, conspiracy theorists claiming that grainy black and white footage from the 1960s shows Russian KGB agents recovering a 13,000-year-old mummified alien body from an ancient tomb in the Egyptian desert. It was codenamed Project Isis in 1961. And one more for you before we move on and start our fantastic program tonight. The story, interesting as well. Whether you believe it to be a case of demonic possession or not, a girl writhes and vomits in spine-chilling footage of exorcism after demonic possession through a Ouija board. Now, I have talked about the Ouija board many times. I'm interested in your take on the Ouija board. You can join us in the chat room. IntoTheParabnormal.wix.com/ITP Radio. If you haven't joined the chat, it's very easy to do so. And then you're in for life. Of course, you can hit up our Facebook page as well. And at Parabnormal Show on Twitter. At Into The Parabnormal on Facebook. Case of demonic possession or not, Nicaragua shows an exorcist casting out a demon from a girl after the supernatural game known as an Ouija board goes horribly wrong. As far as the Ouija board is concerned, well, is it the Ouija board that is really the problem? Is it the Ouija board that is the problem is the question I am asking you? Or does it really just have to do with whoever is using it and in whatever mannerisms they are using it. If you want my honest take on that, well, yes, a gun can kill you, and so can a hammer, most deadly weapon in America. So can a knife, so can a variety of other weapons, such as bombs, you know, are concerned. 818-672-6865 is our number tonight. Get used to it, because if you want to join the program, you can. My guest will be Christopher Gerritano in very, very quick order here. But first, let's set the background for what we're going to be talking about tonight. I introduce you to the Montauk Chronicles.
There are those who say that this quiet town holds many secrets. Legend has it that beneath this very tower, a dark force had its eyes set on the children.
We were told that what was going on there was for the benefit of humanity.
What would you say to the people who say, well, all these children were kidnapped and murdered and you were a part of it? What would you tell them? If they said, well, you know, they're trying to say, well, you were part of this. You approved of this. What would you
I did approve of it. There was nothing I could do about it.
They wanted a large number of programmed boys to be used for mind control operations.
And there are others who say it's still happening to this day.
So it's not like I wanted to believe as that much deception and, I guess, evil out there in the world.
I don't know, I for myself find it a little suspicious that all the evidence has been conveniently destroyed.
Let's put it this way. If you're sitting there with 20 guns pointed at you, what are you going to do?
Whatever the hell they want!
Yeah, isn't that an interesting thought? Whatever. Yeah. Into the Paranormal is the show. I'm Jeremy Scott. And right after Paranormal News each week, I bring on wonderful folks to talk about subjects that might be a little bit out of your peripheral, might be a little bit hard for you to swallow. I understand all that, but ladies and gentlemen, let's be open, because stories like the one we're going to hear tonight from Christopher Gerritano, I believe to be absolutely genuine, and I will tell you my take on them if I believe parts of them not to be. It's all about asking questions, and we will ask plenty of them tonight on A Journey into the Unknown and a Study of Fear, Lies, Paranoia, and the Truth with independent filmmaker Christopher Gerritano. He's executive producer of Montauk Chronicles, known as Area 51 East. It tells the story of Al Bielek, Stuart Swerdlow, and Preston Nichols, who say they were brainwashed and forced against their will by a clandestine organization to take part in secret experiments, along with nearly 100,000 other children. They claim the group was subject to mind control, time travel, extraterrestrial contact, even kidnappings, torture, and murder over about 10 years at Camp Hero Air Force Base in the remote town of Montauk, New York. That's on the very eastern tip of Long Island. You can order the movie at MontaukChronicles.com, M-O-N-T-A-U-K, Chronicles.com. And Christopher is also asking for help to fund his second paranormal project, which is Bigfoot the Movie. You can send your love at GoFundMe.com/Bigfoot the Movie, and we're going to talk about all of this and maybe even a little bit more with Christopher Gerritano. Good evening.
Hello, how are you?
Wonderful. My pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So, you know, I like to start at the very beginning, and we're going to give Montauk Chronicles, you know, lots of time tonight for you to paint the story for us. I've just given our audience not even the tip of the iceberg. But where did the interest in this kind of a story begin for you, Christopher?
Well, I think it certainly began in when I was a child. And one way or another, I was connected to this story. And I kind of realized this in recent years, looking back in hindsight. I was a little kid in the early 80s, and I actually spent my summers in Montauk. Because for those of the people, for those of you that don't know, Montauk is a series of really great beaches and resorts in the summertime. In the wintertime, it's kind of, you know, this sort of a remote fishing village. And there's a place called Montauk Point, which is 5 miles from town, from the small village where the beaches are. Montauk Point is comprised of a lighthouse, a very rocky and jagged beach. And then to the right of that, a few miles, not even a few, about a mile to the right, in deep into the woods, there's this place called the Camp Hero Air Force Base, which I did not know about in its entirety. But when I was a kid, I was walking down the beach at Montauk Point with my uncle and I think my father, or maybe my older brother. And there were a couple of military guys that came out and stopped us when we got to a certain point and said, we can't go any further. And that was my first encounter with Camp Hero, because I didn't even realize there was any kind of military installation there at the time. And this is the very early 80s, so there were still people working there. But according to history, the base wasn't really operational at that time. According to the Montauk legends, it was 1983 when the operation shut down. And now, speaking to people in recent years, they're telling me that things happened there many years later, you know, throughout the years, and perhaps even now. So there was an interest throughout my life in the paranormal. And I guess when it came time for me to make my second movie, I wanted to actually make the Bigfoot film after my first film, Horror Business. And a friend of mine, who I met while making my first documentary, suggested to me, he was actually from Miami, Florida, but he knew of the Montauk Tales. And he said, you know, you're from that area in New York, and why don't you make a movie about that instead? It'll be more accessible to you. You won't have to travel to the Pacific Northwest. And you know, I didn't have a lot of money, so I thought it was a good idea. And he actually came on board as a collaborating co-producer. That was the very first Montauk film that I made, beginning in 06. I made two movies. The one that's out in the world right now is the second one that I started in 2013.
You know,
but that's how it started.
You mentioned the Pacific Northwest. I've lived here all my life. I've yet to encounter a Bigfoot. We'll save that for later on.
And you know what? You may never encounter a Bigfoot, just like friends of mine that are hunters have a hard time encountering what their prey is, what they're hunting, because it's, you know, I don't think it's going to come to you. But we could talk further about that for sure.
Absolutely. I do want to save some time for that in the second hour with Christopher. Al Bielek, Stuart Swerdlow, and Preston Nichols are the three gentlemen that are featured, their stories at least, in Montauk Chronicles. Who were they at the time that that this story takes place?
Well, again, let me try and give you a little perspective on the Montauk legends. Now, the story, as everyone knows it now, has evolved somewhat. When it first came out into the public consciousness, it came out as a story. Well, actually, you know, there were some small gatherings where it really started, with two gentlemen, Alfred Bielek and Preston Nichols. They were telling this tale, a tale of recalled memory, fragments of memory that they had, that they were recognizing, that they were part of something many years earlier. Okay, this is something that they had forgotten, or so they claim. And again, this is all where we only have what they told us. So as Alfred Bielek and Preston Nichols and Stuart Swerdlow and Duncan Cameron go, we only know who they are because of what they're telling us. There has never been, to this day, a shred of documented evidence, including film, including photos, including a resume, anything that was, you know, notarized by any official documents saying that they were there. None of those things exist to this moment. It's really just the stories that they told us. And for a very long time, these gentlemen were the only people telling the tale. Now, there are hundreds, and the number keeps growing. And I've watched this number grow over the years, you know, because I've been involved in this project since 06. So I went to, it went from being something that was very obscure for the most part to something now that it's in mainstream media, and it's going to continue that way. But Alfred Bielek, Preston Nichols, they are men who claim that in between 1971 and 1983, they were both recruited to be part of a secret experiment which was being conducted deep beneath the surface of the Camp Hero Air Force Base in Montauk, New York. And it was for the purposes of developing a mass mind control scenario. It was also for reverse engineering alien technologies for a variety of reasons, one of which was an interstellar, biorhythmic interstellar travel transportation device. It would also transport people back in time to other dimensions. And so they claimed to be somewhat victims because they were recruited against their will. However, they did participate. And in Preston's case, he does give a kind of a contradicting statement where he does say he would go back and do it again if he had the chance. However, they all claim, Preston, Stewart, Alfred, and Duncan, all unanimously claimed.
All right, we got to take a break. Hang on, Christopher Gerritano. We'll continue with you here on Into the Parabnormal, and we'll get more of this story in just a moment. I'm Jeremy Scott. This is Into the Parabnormal, and we're talking Montauk Chronicles, Area 51 East. Later on, Bigfoot. You're in the right place. We'll continue right after this.
You're riding Into the Parabnormal with Jeremy Scott. Somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, you're riding Into the Parabnormal, Jeremy Scott.
Yeah, thanks, Chris McCann. Welcome back. He's Christopher Gerritano, my guest tonight, executive producer of Montauk Chronicles. MontaukChronicles.com, the GoFundMe site for the Bigfoot movie, is GoFundMe.com/Bigfoot the movie. Facebook at Montauk Chronicles Movie. At MTK Chronicles on Twitter, the ways to interact. Christopher is back with us, and right before the break, we were starting to learn about who Al, Stewart, and Preston were, and then the other one is Duncan. So we return to Christopher Gerritano to continue the story.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Okay, great. Basically, I was explaining. Hold on, we got a bit of an echo here on this microphone that wasn't there before when I'm speaking. I don't know if it's gonna. Can you hear it?
I can hear you. You sound a little bit differently than you did before, but I don't think it's too bad.
Okay.
Anyhow, so Preston Nichols and Alfred Bielek claim that they were recruited for this clandestine operation deep beneath the Camp Hero Air Force Base. And it's strange because a lot of things in this story, you know, it was first put forward in the public outside of these small gatherings that I'd mentioned earlier as a book. And the book itself is very small. It's a short read. There isn't really much to it. And the details that are out in the world today about the so-called Montauk Project are immense in comparison to that first book. There have been a lot of books written about it. And so Alfred and Preston claim that they were hired as two separate levels of program director. And what this program was is that the proprietors of this operation, which it was a black operation, so these are like sub-levels and, you know, dark areas of the government, would capture human subjects for the purposes of a mind control experiment. These subjects were mostly taken off the street in record number. You know, the number that Alfred said was in the high, perhaps even 100,000. In the 13-year period, children that were already runaway children that were taken off the street and used as human subjects over that, you know, well over a decade. And what happened was once the children were taken down to the base, they were put through a series of brutal experiments with the purposes of fracturing their mind. So they were beaten. They were given heavy doses of hallucinogens. They were brought to places of extreme fear. They were raped. Just every horrible atrocity you could think of were done to these kids to bring them into a place where their minds would fracture, is the term that Preston was using, and then the programming would be placed inside that moment, that deep fear-based part of their mind where it was hidden, and later be used with a triggering mechanism, whether it be a word or a symbol or whatever, to get them to do what they wanted them to do in terms of the mind control. That was one of the things. And so Preston's job was, after the beatings occurred, after the horrible atrocities occurred to the kids, his job was to start to put their minds back together and help put the programming in. Alfred's job, so he claims, was, after that procedure was done, he would work with the children who had heightened psychic abilities, and he would help them. He saw it as a psychic director. This is what his job title was. And again, we only have the stories of these men to go on. In the early days, they were meeting at these gatherings in and out of New York City, small gatherings, you know, people that would talk about abduction experiences and other things like that. So these gentlemen were out there telling this tale. And then it was published as a book, and now, over the years, it started to gain attention, and the story grew as well. And so that's what these gentlemen said they did. In Stuart Swerdlow's case, he claims that he was actually one of the boys that were recruited into the program very early on in his life. And using that biorhythmic wormhole technology, it is said that he was extracted at times from his bedroom at home and brought into the program using that technology. But also all of the same atrocities were said to have happened to him as well, and that's what he claims happened to him. Once again, we have no record of anything. We don't have any artifacts. We don't have any pictures. And it's just the stories that these men are telling.
Are we talking something in the range of maybe 100,000 children part of
in
this?
In 13 years. Yeah, well, when I first heard that number, I just like you are saying to yourself right now, and most people that are listening, you say that's impossible. Well, if you do your research, you'll start to see it's an astonishing amount of people that go missing every year just in this country alone. It would blow your mind. So, I mean, at first, I didn't believe any of it. You know, when I stepped, I personally spent time. See, I wasn't adapting a book. I didn't sit on Wikipedia and just read something and try to make a movie out of it. I literally said, look, I'm wiping the slate clean. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to every single one of these men and begin my own investigation. I'm going to go to the base. I'm going to go into the base. I'm going to go into the tower. So that's exactly what I did when I made this movie. I started clean slate, and I went out and started asking questions. And I went to the Montauk Library Archives, and I went to Alfred Bielek's home in Fort Myers, Florida, and I went to Preston Nichols' home in Cairo, New York, and I went to Stuart Swerdlow's home in St. Joseph, Michigan. So I went to all of these places and spent time with these people to just ask questions. I wanted to see them face to face. And I was always cross-referencing certain things that they would say, everything from references back to Project Operation Paperclip, because they said that was a, you know, Montauk, the Montauk Project was derived from those Nazi scientists that were brought over for Operation Paperclip, references to MK Ultra, all of these things. You know, I did as much research as possible, and firsthand, most of it was spending time with these people and going to the locations. So, yeah, I mean, everything that was said seems far-fetched. But then once you do a little research, and what my experience was over that, you know, almost 10-year period making the two movies, a lot of it became believable. Some of it, I think, was fabricated for the book by the publisher, you know, because it seems like a tidy little science fiction tale. And he avoided a lot of the Montauk Boys stuff. And what made sense to me was that they did that on purpose, you know, because they didn't want to scare people and they didn't want to get into that. But what I think happened, what I think really happened, and it's not, I'm not denying the possibilities of extraterrestrial life or the fact that we had advanced technologies or even time travel. I mean, I believe all of these things are possible, especially, you know, extraterrestrial life, intelligent extraterrestrial life. But I don't know if it was actually at this program, because the people that were there, it's almost like the things they're describing are from some bad science fiction movie. And so I always thought, well, what better way to conceal mass murder, illegal murder, kidnapping, than to create a hallucination for the people involved? If they were to ever tell the tale, they would seem like they're crazy. So I considered that heavily and consider it to this moment.
Christopher, I'm wondering why these group of kids. I know that Al Bielek not only was is involved in this case that we're talking about, but the Philadelphia experiment as well. And so the question is, if it is 100,000, why these 100,000 kids? Why not a separate group? Were there certain traits, whatnot, that whoever was at the helm of this operation was looking for in their subjects?
Yeah, well, according to Stuart Swerdlow and Alfred Bielek, they were looking for particular kids that had a specific genetics. But a lot of the kids were just taken as expendable subjects because, according to Alfred and everybody else, they needed live human subjects for these biorhythmic transportation experiments. So they were just putting people through these machines, not knowing what was going to happen exactly to them, misleading them. And according to Stewart and everybody else, they said a lot of the kids died in the process. A lot of these kids were runaways in New York City and Long Island. And again, this is their tale. I'm just the guy that went in and recorded them and listened to what they had to say and kept an open mind and put it on film for everybody else. And that was
died as a result of what happened or died after the fact?
Oh, no, died either in the process of being beaten half to death, heavily drugged, put through the transportation, time travel, or the interstellar travel biorhythmic systems, a variety of things that they died from. And then there was this other theory that Stuart Swerdlow said a good deal of them were purposefully killed to extract adrenochrome from the pineal gland. So, I mean, there's such a variety of things coming out of this story. It could fill an encyclopedia. I mean, everything that you can imagine happened, these guys say happened there. I mean, we have everything from monsters to aliens, the mind control experiments, the time travel experiments. It's all happened underneath Camp Hero. And, my focus is because of things like MKUltra and something a bit different but just as atrocious, the Tuskegee experiments and other alike experiments that we know of, that we know really did happen, I'm heavily considering that there was a, you know, because again, it's not proven, but I believe that something happened underneath Camp Hero, and it was probably something very similar to what these men are saying, that they were just capturing. You know, in the 1970s, it was much easier to disappear. These kids were already runaways and gone for a very long time, and they were being taken and used as easy subjects. You know, no one would miss them. They're expendable, and they don't have to pay anybody, and they just grab these kids off the street. It makes sense, and I wouldn't put it past the darker sides of the government to have done that, because they've done that and worse, and we know it.
Have you've spoken with each of these three gentlemen, that's correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, every single one of them, including Duncan Cameron, who didn't appear in the film. The interviews you see in my movie, I shot those, so that's, you know, I was there.
I'm just wondering how many of them are still with us. Are there others that you could talk to? I mean, your story is absolutely credible and amazing, but I'm just wondering, what's the reaction maybe when you reach out to some of these other subjects who are involved? Have you been able to?
Oh yeah. Well, now Alfred passed away in 2011.
No.
So he's gone. Preston Nichols is, I hear, not doing so well. And so he might not be with us for very much longer. I don't know. I hear he's very sick. Stuart Swerdlow is very much alive, and he teaches courses on how to deal with mind control. And he goes around the world, and I mean, he's very, you know, well respected in his field. And he gives lectures all over the world, really, and tells his story. But outside of that, to answer your question specifically, there are a lot of other people now saying that they were, and I'm sure you've heard this term, super soldiers, very similar, almost identical programs to the Montauk Project. Alfred did tell me in the interviews that it wasn't just happening beneath Camp Hero. There were other places all around the country, the United States, and all around the world where this was occurring. So, you know, this is so different, so much different than these kind of exhilarating and stimulating stories I grew up obsessing over, everything from, you know, flying saucers in the night, not even so much abductions, hauntings, you know, sightings of Bigfoot, cryptozoological creatures. These myths were exhilarating and stimulating. When you get to the Montauk Project, it is quite depressing. It's terrifying. It's paradigm shifting, because you if you were to believe in any of it, it kind of has this ripple effect where, you know, it causes a lot of anxiety, because it's like, if you believe in this stuff, you must believe that a lot of what we know is orchestrated, and it's very much a lie, you know, the way the world's operating and who's operating it. So the Montauk tale is very different than everything that I even enjoy to this day, of course, in the world of the paranormal or the supernatural, or the occult, even. You know, it's so different than that. It's actually very insidious at its core. You know, it has a very insidious vibe to the whole thing when you really imagine what it's like. And that's why my film is at times very dark, because that's what it is. We're talking about a mass murder. We're talking about children being kidnapped and brutalized for a mind control experiment. And even there, if there were aliens there, and even if the experiments were to travel to different dimensions or different planets or different times, it's still some really horrible stuff that's happening in the name of science. And so I think that's what should be focused on. These programs that have happened, we have been able to prove a few of them, not as elaborate as the Montauk story, but definitely as brutal and as insidious. So I continue to search, and people keep popping up. And I've been able to find more people in the last 2 years than in the last 10. You know, so many people have been coming forward saying they were part of these things. It's really happening a lot now.
Christopher, give us a sense of what kind of time frame we're looking at. When was this alleged to have happened? And do we still believe that maybe to a point it could still be happening today?
Oh, for sure. What was happening, so they say, between 1971 and 1983 at Montauk, there are other programs that happened previously, like MK Ultra and the Tuskegee experiments that were somewhat overlapping, but happening before it as well. And, you know, and we can go to throughout history, even World War II and Nazi Germany and, you know, all sorts of places where horrible things were occurring. But, yeah, it was that 13-year period. And if I consider this, so in 13 years, something was being developed there. When you're developing something, eventually you'd like to apply it and use it. And so there are a lot who believe that it's being used right now in many different ways, on the general public, on the people who are popping up every 2 weeks, shooting people just out of the blue.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. So it's way too strange to not consider this as a possibility. You know, we have to stop turning our heads to the possibility that something insidious is running the show. And I want to live my life. You want to live your life. Everybody wants to live a good, happy life. But if these things are really going on, if this level of manipulation is truly happening, we really should know, so we can avoid any of this affecting us. And then hopefully maybe something can be done about it. You know, that, and that's why this is so separate from the world of entertainment. Yeah, there are entertaining aspects to it, but when you're talking about children that are being murdered in record number, it changes the whole game. And again, I was immersed in this for 9 years, so I don't sound very enthusiastic about the Montauk project, because I'm not. It's caused a lot of anxiety for me, caused a lot of problems, you know, being buried in this story for so long. And I'm continuing with it, regardless of my other projects, which to me are the most important thing right now. I have to continue this investigation. I just like I was compelled to do it over 9 years, I'm still compelled to continue.
Christopher, what was Camp Hero Air Force Base primarily used back at that particular time for?
Sure. They were U.S.-developed semi-automatic ground environment, the SAGE radar tower. And that's that big radar tower you see at Camp Hero. Well, you know, there were many stages of Camp Hero. Camp Hero was Camp Hero in World War II and throughout that time. And then they developed the radar technology. But before that, it was Fort Hero, and it was also a location where we go back to the Spanish-American War, where Theodore Roosevelt and the Rough Riders were out in that, just that very area. So there was always, even George Washington was out there, even further back. So it was always an area of interest for some reason, that maybe because of it was just so remote, and it was right on the edge of the ocean, I don't know, but it was always an area of interest. And so around 1971, after the radar tower was becoming obsolete because satellite technology was replacing it, the Air Force was moving its way out. And according to Alfred, on record, they say that IBM was facilitating the place and using the underground facility, which I've never seen. And there's so much speculation that there's this big underground lab there that goes down, you know, many levels. But Alfred said there were larger companies investing in it. And then it was this group, this, you know, secret government, you know, black ops that went in and facilitated the place between 1971 and 1983. And that, according to Preston and Alfred, the Nazi scientists who graduated from, you know, who were part of Operation Paperclip and worked at Brookhaven Labs. There's Brookhaven National Laboratories is a little further west than Camp Hero. And according to Alfred and Preston, the way they got into Camp Hero was from an underground transport that would lead them from, because they would check in at Brookhaven Laboratories, and then they would take the underground transport over to Camp Hero to the underground base. So there are people that have come out into the public and said, well, I worked at Camp Hero at this time and that time, and I don't remember seeing any of this, and this is all, you know, this is all bunk. But the idea is that the guy's topside would have never understood what was going on underground because it's compartmentalized. So they, you know, they they don't know about each other, and that the transportation system went from Brookhaven underground to the base underneath Camp Hero. This is what these guys say. It's just so much information, so elaborate, and sometimes it kind of contradicts. Like, for instance, this is why I feel like some of the stuff was invented, you know, in the book to kind of make a tidy story for the public. When that first book came out, and they still kind of tell this tale that when they were crashing the project, Alfred Bielek, Preston Nichols, and Duncan Cameron claimed to have stepped out of Camp Hero momentarily for an afternoon. They met in the Memory Motel, which is in further down in the village, to have this session where they planned to crash the project because they didn't want the mind control to be spread to the mass population. And then they went back in. But my question is, and I always found this to be very silly, if these guys were taken against their will to be part of a really secret operation where these horrible and very top secret things were occurring on a daily basis, and that they were only brought from Brookhaven Labs to Camp Hero under the ground, how on earth did they step out for a few moments unsupervised from this top secret program that had basically kidnapped them to go have a meeting to plan to crash the project and then just kind of mosey on back to the old base and, you know, destroy everything? So I never really bought that part of the story. And it's either an implanted memory to kind of make them seem not credible, or it was just something fabricated to kind of tie the story together for the book. So I'm kind of leaning towards the latter, but I never really bought that part of the story.
Christopher, tell folks where they can find more information about the project we're talking about right here, Montauk Chronicles.
Sure. Well, my movie, I know, is the most detailed and the most comprehensive version of the story, because you're getting it directly from the guys who put this story out in the world in the first place. They're in the movie. Those interviews are unique to my movie, and they're telling the tale. In terms of my movie, you go to MontaukChronicles.com or Amazon.com, and you can order the film. It's a 2-hour movie. There's a lot in there. If you're paying attention to the film and not shuttling through it or something online, you'll absorb all the information. But there are a variety of books as well. I would say check everything out, but check out the movie, because the reason why the movie is most important is because those books are very biased. They're written by the gentleman in my film and by a publisher. And so I think you want to really observe the men as they tell you the tale, and it's very emotional, and it's very real. I tried to get some real interviews out of these guys. So.
All right, hang tight, Christopher. Geritano, we've got a break right there, but we will be coming back in very short order to continue our conversation about Area 51 East, Montauk Chronicles. I am Jeremy Scott. We're taking you into the parabnormal.
Major sighting here.
It's all over the place.
Holy.
Para, abnormal.
I see dead people walking around like regular people.
Parabnormal. Somewhere between abnormal and paranormal.
I felt like something was near me, kind of a eerie feeling.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
Jeremy Scott asks the questions that we're all dying to know.
You can't handle the truth!
Hello? Hello?
You can't keep him down, no matter how hard you try.
Hey, that's the guy! And he's back for more!
Traveling into the witching hour from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, you're riding into the paranormal.
Yeah, into hour two. Coming up next week on the program, I'm going to be joined by Kim Babcock and Aliza Metis, MD, as we talk channeling in the afterlife. Ufologist Peter Robbins is here the week after, August the 13th. He's kind of a big deal. Also, Eugene Braxton, America's Mystic, talking NDEs on August the 20th. And Yes, I teased it last week, an additional show on the last Sunday of the month. We'll start it off on August the 28th with a well-known name in the field, Preston Dennett. That's right, two shows the final weekend of the month, both Saturday and Sunday, same time, same place. Our affiliates, WLRU and Valentine Radio, will be with us for those shows. Of course, we are on Spreaker, we're on TuneIn, and our podcasts are available for all to see all the time. And for free, of course, by going to YouTube, and please subscribe to our channel while you are there. Christopher Gerritano is my guest, executive producer of Montauk Chronicles and Bigfoot the Movie. You can go to intotheparanormal.wix.com/ITP radio or click from @ParanormalShow on Twitter and @IntoTheParanormal on Facebook links to Christopher Gerritano's work. We put the trailer up a couple of days ago. Of course, we heard that at the beginning of the conversation with Christopher. Al Bielek, Stuart Swerdlow, Preston Nichols, and, oh, about 100,000 other children. Tell a story of the Montauk Chronicles being brainwashed and forced against their will by a clandestine organization to take part in secret experiments. And we're hearing about what those are with my guest, Christopher Gerritano, tonight. We've got many questions as far as this is concerned, like why? What was the purpose of all this, Christopher? Any idea?
Yeah, well, as we were discussing earlier, I don't know the purpose of it. I know what I was told. And what I was told the purpose was to develop initially was to develop a mind control. Then it was to develop and reverse engineer alien technology to be used for the purposes of interstellar travel, time travel, interdimensional travel. I mean, these are all these things that these guys said it was used for over the 13-year period. But the most believable aspect was the whole mind control thing. You know, I mean, like developing Manchurian type assassins is not that far-fetched. It's a far-fetched to people who don't dive into the research and spend time really thinking about it and understanding history and things that have happened that can be proven. You know, we unfortunately, a lot of people just automatically assume that if it's not in front of them and they don't know about it, then it couldn't possibly be true.
That's silly.
Of course, that's ridiculous. So, yeah, I mean, that's what these men said, and they have no proof of it. But again, we have this associative reference that we can go back and look at other things and contrast and compare some of the things that these gentlemen were talking about to other things that we do have evidence of, that we have more credible witnesses. And I'm not saying these men aren't credible, but usually, to me, a credible witness is somebody with something to lose. If they have a position in the government, a job to lose at a company, they don't want to be known, but they're trying to blow the whistle without losing a job or a pension or something. To me, those are credible witnesses. They're not trying to get paid for it. They're not trying to sensationalize it or sell books or go to conventions and constantly talk about it unless it's trying to inform people. And so I think in time more credible witnesses will surface, and either they'll validate what these gentlemen started to talk about in the 90s or clarify it, and at least parts of it might be validated, parts of the story. So, you know, that's what I was working on, and I found it fascinating just as a whole, you know, to hear these grown and in some cases elderly men tell this tale, to me in itself was fascinating. So that's where I began. I thought it was just a great idea to visit them and as a filmmaker, ask them questions and see what they have to say. Making this movie was not, you know, I'm not like this. I'm a skeptic. I went in as a skeptic, but not as a cynic, you know, and I wanted to hear what they had to say because I kept a very open mind. But I am not the type who just believes just because someone's telling me something. I need a little bit more than that. But it doesn't mean I can't be fascinated at a at a story, you know,
as do
the details of it.
Proof, yes, Christopher.
Sure.
You know, many of these victims, whatever you want to call it, did not escape with their lives. I can imagine what effect psychological and whatnot it might have had on these three men. Can you speak to that?
Again, you know, there's no corpus delicti. There are no bodies at this time. There's no evidence that any children were murdered in this program, except for the people that start to surface now and say they survived it. You know, in addition to Alfred Preston and Stewart. And how it affected their minds, again, I can tell you what I was told and what you'll see their testimonies in the film. And my job as a filmmaker, of course, was to record what they had to say and present it to you so you can also hear it. So, but what they said was that everybody varied. I mean, in Stewart's case, he claimed to have been one of the boys. So, of course, he said when the project was over, he was a shattered human being. And he needed to be put back together. You know, he was traumatized severely, and to this day he's traumatized. So what he's out there teaching are techniques to kind of resist the mind control, to filter it out of your life and to heal. Because according to Stewart and according to the rest of these gentlemen, we're all programmed to one degree or another, and we don't even know it. Because what was being developed in these projects, Montauk and alike projects, is now being applied, like I said earlier. So everything from, you know, according to Stewart, it's being put through our televisions, it's being put through the internet, you know, these devices that we keep on us all day long. You know, he's saying that the programming is all coming through that. So a lot of us are really programmed, and it goes much deeper than that. These gentlemen claim that it's like a matrix-like situation where everything that you've known in your lifetime is a lie. So if you're submitting to the idea of the Montauk Project, you should also submit to the fact that your life has been kind of an illusion. It's been orchestrated by these kind of sub-government types that are running the world, according to these guys. And many other people actually are saying these things too. I'm sure you're aware of it.
Oh, absolutely. Almost every day I come across a story. I said, who said what?
Sure.
Usually those are the ones that get on the air
and
first.
Right. Well, that's a healthy reaction, because you should question it. You shouldn't. I think it's very unhealthy if someone's to tell you, ooh, the secret evil man is controlling your life and I have the cure. Well, you know, I was fine yesterday, and now I'm sitting here thinking, because of what you told me, I'm starting to get very sick and scared. So there's something to that. And a lot of people say, well, it's because you're starting to realize it, and it's hard to realize these things. Well, I question that too. I mean, they say ignorance is bliss. I don't think it's exactly ignorance. The power of suggestion can make you think that you're under control, that you're every move is being controlled. Now, with the idea put in your mind that everything you're doing is a manipulation, that will cause you to be concerned about your every move, to be totally overly self-conscious of things that you're doing, and then question, why am I doing this? Is it because I'm being controlled? And I think that can cause someone to go crazy. And I think in many cases it has. But there's something to it at the same time, I think, because I see the manipulation in the news, for instance, and I had not watched television in 2 years, but recently I was visiting relatives, and wow, the manipulation is blatant. Now, I can't say it's because of this insidious government program. It could be just for advertising, you know, to get people to keep watching. But something's really strange, because, you know, it seems like they're trying on one end to really rile everyone up, put everybody against each other, create chaos. I mean, this whole recent racism thing, I live in the world. So, you know, I don't just sit here on the internet all day. You know, I walk around, and it seems like racism in this country was at an all-time low a couple of years ago. Where the hell is it coming from now? And if you pay attention, it seems like these little news reports are pitting people against each other. Now, how does this associate to the mind control thing? Well, it does, because it's like if it is being done on purpose, they know they're pulling strings and trying to cause civil unrest. What's the reason for the civil unrest? What's the reason for the shootings? Why do they keep pumping that there's diseases going to kill everybody and all this destruction? You know, it could be to control people.
The Zika virus, that one, right, Chris? You heard of that one?
Well, that was one of them. I mean, if we're going to make light of this, I don't want to talk about it. But, if we're going to talk serious for a minute, yeah, I'd like to continue.
No, absolutely. I'm just saying that the Zika virus is kind of one of those things that they weren't first really even concerned of. And then all of a sudden, oh, we're a little bit more concerned than what we were. And now there's a health official who says it's actually one of the, you know, most difficult emergency responses ever. So, you know, that's all I'm saying there. As far as your road into making Montauk Chronicles, you go about it a little bit differently than some of the folks I have on this program. Many start to investigate the paranormal, and then on comes, you know, a television producer and dangles the carrot. Hey, you know, you should come do a television program, or, you know, spend a whole bunch of money and send us a pilot, and if we like it enough, maybe it'll get on the air. You are a filmmaker first with an interest in the paranormal. So tell us first how you got into film, and then I'd like you to take us down the road of what actually went into making Montauk Chronicles.
Well, how I got into film was I was a child who was just, you know, I was subjected to movies on a daily basis because my parents owned a video store. So I grew up in a video store and I got to see everything, and this is in the early 80s. I was born in 76. So, and it's all I ever wanted to do. You know, I got into special effects makeup as a kid. I ended up at 12 years old, meeting a really great, talented makeup artist, Jay Wells, who was trained by a guy named Dick Smith, who did the makeup for The Exorcist and The Godfather and stuff like that. And so I grew up in his makeup shop, and I really wanted to learn special effects makeup and continued on making short films. And then I went to film school, college in New York City, School of Visual Arts, and graduated in 2000. And I worked for Panavision for a little while and, you know, shot commercials and stuff like that. And just wanted to be independent and make my own films. At that time, the technology wasn't what it is now, so you really just had to suffer through. And then around, I think it was 2002 or three, there was a revolutionary camera called the Panasonic DVX-100, which shot in 24 frames per second, which is what most of your motion pictures are running in. And that kind of changed the game a little bit. So that's when I started shooting my first film that I had every intention of bringing out into the world, which was a feature length documentary called Horror Business. And, the way I got into the Montauk thing I had told you earlier, it was just, it was interesting to me. I wasn't, you know, I knew about the book years earlier, but I read it and I didn't like it. I didn't think it was believable. I couldn't wrap my head around the situation. It was, it felt like there was just a lot of jumbled pieces in there.
Okay, so how then do you decide you want to make, it right, I guess?
To start my own investigation from scratch, to go and speak to these men who are telling this kind of outlandish tale, because to me it was, you know, science fiction at the time, even though I, keeping a very open mind and, with the knowledge we have of infinite space and the galaxies and infinite solar systems out there, billions and billions of galaxies, it's probable that, of course, there's something intelligent and, you know, that exists out there and most likely has visited this planet and who knows. But, you know, and I felt that way. But I don't see everything in black and white. So I could be interested in something for the simple reason that I'm interested in hearing what these gentlemen have to say. And so that's how it started. These guys wrote this book, but they exist. And so instead of bringing them into a studio situation where you have five jerks who don't care about anything, making everyone feel uncomfortable, because that seems to be the zeitgeist in a lot of TV, you know, situations. Because when you're interviewing someone, and I've interviewed a lot of people, not just from Montauk Chronicles, but, you know, I've worked on other projects. One of the main things you need to keep in mind is if you want anything good out of the person, you need to make them feel comfortable and welcome. If they don't feel comfortable, they're not going to give you anything worth listening to. So I knew that. I didn't believe these men to start, but I made a point to be respectful and ask questions and listen to what they had to say. And I got great stuff. But, you know, by 2012, I had a finished version of it. I was working on other projects and I just wasn't happy with it. Technology changed rapidly in that 6 years. And by the end of the 6 years, there was even more revolutionary equipment out there for independent filmmakers. And I had also improved as a movie maker, but the work felt very stale to me. So I had a finished film that I literally threw away and started all over again in 2013. And that's the one that's out in the world at the moment. And that's the one that I released. And I went back because I wanted to even, you know, Alfred Bielek died in 2011. Luckily, his interviews are pretty good. But I wanted to go back and re-interview Preston and Stewart and ask them very hard questions, which I did. And the difference between the older interviews and the new ones are very stark because, you know, the vibe is more serious. And I really said to them, you know, look, you're out in the world telling this tale. I'm giving you a chance to tell your story. I mean, I want to hear details. I want to know how you feel about the murders. I want to know how you feel about participating in these things. And so that was my approach.
Christopher, does your work on Montauk end here? Do you have maybe sequels and other investigations in the works or in thought, I guess, at this time?
Yeah, actually, I'm working on a television project, and it's the antithesis to what you were describing earlier, because the gentleman that I'm working with right now really believe that something good can come out of it and something interesting and intelligent can be made out of it. And it's not just some, you know, one-off being made by somebody who made the Jersey Shore or some, you know, idiotic show like that. And so I like their attention to detail. I like how serious they are. And so I'm collaborating right now, and we're moving forward. And I can't say what network it is right now, but we actually have, you know, it's being financed by the network, and we're moving forward on not the pilot, but the first 2-hour special. So
that is absolutely
amazing.
Fantastic news.
Yeah. Yeah.
Christopher, so, do you believe that, much like this project, there could be other like projects of their kind that either were going on or may still be going on?
Of course, because in 1995, if you recall, or I'm not sure if you know, or any of the folks at home know, but in 1995, there was a congressional hearing. And in that congressional hearing, President Bill Clinton, and you can find this footage online, kind of halfway admitted to these things. Now, he was admitting to the Tuskegee medical experiments, which, if you don't know, were a series of gentlemen and people that were injected with syphilis. Unbeknownst to them, they were lied to by our American government, lied to and injected with syphilis and monitored over, I think, a 10-year period to see how the disease would affect them. This was criminal and disgusting behavior by the, you know, the governments of that time. And Bill Clinton came forward in 95 to apologize publicly and say, well, that was very un-American of those people, and there were some strange facets of our government at the time. He also slightly admitted to so-called radiation experiments. At the same time, there was a congressional hearing with a woman named Christy Nicola and a few other people. This appears somewhat in the third act of Montauk Chronicles, so you get a little bit of a background on this. And she and many other people insisted that these weren't, first of all, if they were radiation experiments illegally done in the same vein of the Tuskegee experiments, it's still atrocious, but she insisted and described what the experiments actually were, insisted that they were mind control experiments when she was a younger lady. And this happened to many other people. And Congress listened. And they were actually, some of them were compensated. And Clinton admitted to some of this stuff. So, and what she described was almost identical to the techniques being used in the so-called Montauk Project. And this is why I considered it as truth. Because if it can happen in one place, of course, it could happen in another, and most likely it was. Now, I'm not so quick to believe that it was just happening during that period of years by a bunch of wacko people in the government. Then they disappeared and the president in 95 apologized for it. I find that hard to believe. I find it hard to believe that we allowed it to happen in the first place, but we did. And if it happened then, I rest assured something's happening now. I mean, where was all this research going? What were they developing? Why was it even allowed to be developed in the first place? Shouldn't this be checked out? And those are questions you need to ask, because we go from the world of the paranormal to the world of, you know, something much more insidious and detrimental than that, you know, than entertainment.
Break time with Christopher Gerritano. It's our final break, and then we are back with a final half hour. Riding into the paranormal with you every single Saturday night at this time, at this place. When we come back, we're on the hunt of Bigfoot. Stick with us. I'm Jeremy Scott.
Into the paranormal. Hour every Saturday night into the paranormal.
It was kind of creepy that it was making all this noise, like trying to intimidate us. And then we go up to look for it and it goes and hides. So once the sun went down, it seemed like the best thing to do was to leave.
Who knows what type of impact it would have on the species to kill one. It would take me not having a choice. If this thing was coming after me, I'm going to put a bullet in it.
They've been around a long time. When the Indians talked about them, hundreds of years ago. They've been here a long time. Be like on a deer trail, a well-traveled deer trail, and another one will further up, and we'll flush the deer, and the deer will panic, and they'll run down that trail, and another one will ambush it as it comes through. They'll break the neck. We actually saw the shadow of one, and then he stood up, and the fire was reflected in his eyes, and as he stood, he must have been 8-9 feet tall.
Hair coming down the sides of it, down the arms of it, and it was just a massive animal.
I would like to prove it in a non-lethal way. Hopefully with enough hair samples, maybe get lucky and get a tissue sample.
We're in their territory, and they were trying to scare us out, and we refused to go, and we just didn't know how much we could push it. We had no idea what the boundaries were. Two nights there, we didn't think we'd make it to see the dawn.
Bigfoot the movie, Christopher Gerritano, executive producer of that, and also Montauk Chronicles tonight, montaukchronicles.com. Also, the Bigfoot movie is gofundme.com/Bigfoot the movie. And if you could help Christopher Gerritano out, I know that he would appreciate it. Chris, that is correct. You are still in the fundraising stage, correct? Actually, let's turn Christopher back up. Now we can hear you, sir.
Okay, yeah. The reason why I went forward originally with the... I shot a lot of footage for Bigfoot between October and the end of December. I started the fundraiser, I think, in February or something, or March. And the reason for it was I had a few potential investors. And the problem is when you have people who are getting involved, it's very difficult to get involved with someone who will kind of leave you alone and allow you to make the picture. And of course, you're working, you're doing all the work. So someone puts a little bit of money into a movie, they feel like they have power over it, and they'll end up, you know, being a detriment more so than any kind of a help. So to avoid that, I felt if there were enough people out there that maybe may have seen Montauk Chronicles and know of me and would trust me to do a good job with this picture, that they would want to, by their own free will, join in and join with us and see if they could help us get this production made. We were very short of the goal, but I've stuck to my obligations to my micro producers and to myself. And of course, I'm heavily in pre-production for the film, but I am seeking private investment at the moment. But the door is open for anybody who wants to join us as a micro producer. If you go and check out the GoFundMe page, have a look. If any of those perks seem like there's something you want to receive or be a part of, it might be worth joining up with us. I've been working on a web series called Making Bigfoot that I'm putting out there for free, and you'll get that as also as part of even a small donation. But again, it's up to you if you want to be a part of it. I'm going forward with my picture as I started, and regardless of what we could raise, it's just I think the crowdsource funds are a good thing because it allows the artist, in my case, to make my film without interference. You know, I am the executive producer of the project, but I'm also the cinematographer, director, writer, editor, and everything else you can think of.
I was just going to ask you how many hats you wore, so we'll check that one off. And again, GoFundMe.com/BigfootTheMovie. That's where you can help Christopher Gerritano out. If you're interested in some conclusive proof, maybe one day, and it just might come with his documentary, make sure you go to GoFundMe.com/BigfootTheMovie. Of course, Christopher, you have to be fascinated with the Bigfoot subject to even want to make such a movie. What are your thoughts on the species? I know that's pretty open-ended.
Well, number one, yes, it's been an obsession since I was a kid, and I always wanted to make something on it since I saw In Search Of as a kid, and I collected several books as a kid on the subject matter. The way I feel about it now, and I'll try and give you the brief version, is that I think we have to stop, even though I respect very much Jeff Meldrum's research and Grover Krantz and people like that, but I think that we should stop trying to look at it as some kind of gorilla and consider it as something in between man and ape, and that they've been around for a long time, and that there have been a lot of credible people that have seen them through different parts of the world, not just the United States, and throughout history. And so you must consider that as a strong possibility. I don't know how you feel about it, but an intelligent person with an open mind, I think just because we don't have a sample of it, would also understand that that doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't exist. Credible witness is important. Ideas and stories are important. I've seen a bear in the wilderness, okay? I didn't look at the bear and say, oh, it's Bigfoot. You know, I mean, we're talking about hunters that see animals all the time. It's like, oh, I saw a cat the other day. It must have been a werewolf. You know, it's like, so a lot of people, like the heavy skeptics, want to come out and say, oh, you just saw a bear walking upright. Look, I know what a bear looks like. Okay. I know the difference. And when you see something that's extraordinarily different than what, the skeptics try and lay down on the people that see these things, I don't understand that mentality. It's a very narrow way of thinking. But what I think is that the reason why the breeding populations, so to speak, are low is because they're more like, the species is more like a tribal or family-oriented type thing, where they know that they need to keep the population low. They're conscious of it because they don't want to be found. And I think a lot of these Bigfoot hunts are not a very good thing, because what's going to happen is, even if the people with good intentions who want to mingle or find evidence, what you're going to do is, if you do find evidence, if you do, you're going to point the bad guys right in that direction. The guys with the high-powered rifles who want to get a corpse to sell it and make money, you point out that location, those guys will go there, and they will go there and they'll kill these things. It's just the way it's going to happen. So I think what we're dealing with is a species that knows about us, that knows about how messed up we are, because they've been watching us for, you know, many, many, many centuries, and seeing how this country was forged in war and blood and genocide and all sorts of crazy things that happened that they saw, perhaps, and I'm just offering up a theory, is that they retreated, became reclusive and elusive for a very good reason, and it's that they don't, every time a human comes into the woods with a rifle, they know that these aren't the creatures what they want to be near. And probably just like most animals. But this is a bit different. And I think that's why they're the way they are. They don't want to be found. They don't want to be found at all. And for very good reason. And so that's a theme that's going to be running through my picture. So any violence or any, you know, because of this, the Ape Canyon story and the Bauman tale that Theodore Roosevelt tells in his book, The Wilderness Hunter, they are quite terrifying, but they're all of them that I've read were provoked. You know, these kind of violent encounters were provoked. You know, somebody with a rifle took a shot at one first, and then there was some kind of retaliation, usually. So that's the way I'm focusing on it. I'm picking several stories throughout history that I feel are very important to the lineage and to the whole provenance of this Sasquatch thing, and I'd like to tell it in my picture. There are too many documentaries about it, too many TV specials about it, and I'm doing something very different, and that's what I'd like to do, because I think we need something different on the subject and something definitive, so I'm working very hard to put that together.
And particularly, where are you focused on? I know you're not necessarily out necessarily maybe in the trenches, or maybe you are looking for Bigfoot, but where do you believe that, if Bigfoot existed, would be the best chances of being found?
I'm not looking. I decided against it. I was in Foley Swamp, Michigan. That's upstate Michigan, and outside of a town called Mayo, which is one of the nation's hotspots for seeing these things. A lot of hunters have seen them out there, with a guy named Joe Stewart, who encountered one in the 60s. And that's the gentleman you see in that preview trailer. And I just thought about it for a while, and I felt like maybe I shouldn't. Maybe there shouldn't be an expedition. Maybe we shouldn't find this thing. Maybe it doesn't want to be found. And that really is the catalyst that is evolving my picture into something I feel much more important and better movie that'll stand out from everything else that's been made. And we'll satisfy anybody who's interested in the subject matter for sure. But my job, I think, is not to find these things. I really thought about it. I mean, what good is it going to do, really? What are you going to discover? I really am. I'm a firm believer that if we find their location, bad things are going to happen. What's going to happen is you're going to have a lot of hunters go down there and kill these things. It's just going to happen. What's going to happen? What could possibly happen next? You know, you're not going to keep those guys away. They're going to go down there and they're going to shoot these things. So I to answer that question, where I think they are, probably near you, but you're not going to find them unless you spend 3 months out there, you know, deep, deep wilderness, and very in some kind of stealth mode, maybe by yourself all that time, and maybe you'll have a chance at finding one, because they have the vantage point. So of course, if you're just taking a little stroll through the woods or the backyard, you know, you're not going to find one. But people have encountered them, you know, just being out in the woods. So there are those opportunities if you're really looking to encounter something. I personally would be afraid, to tell you the truth, after what I've read and a lot of the things I've learned about. I mean, they don't really like human beings, as far as I could see. There are a group of people out there that, for some reason, believe that, you know, we're all going to get along. And I don't think that's the case. These things are elusive for a reason. And as nice as you might be, you're going to draw the problems to them. So I think if you do believe they exist, I do, because you know, listen, is it that far fetched to believe that this creature exists with all of the things that we have specimens of on this earth that are infinitely more bizarre? Do you really find it that hard to believe? I mean, I don't. So I think it would be irresponsible to point them out at this time, you know, because there's probably very few of them and they'll be killed.
And I, much like Christopher, do believe that Bigfoot are real, Sasquatch, whatever you'd like to call them. Some also say that you know, there's other names for them, skunk ape and whatnot. But we're all pretty much talking about the same thing, and there are far too many people, hunters and whatnot, just people, general, average, regular people, everyday people. Hey, there was a song about that, who say that they have come in contact with Bigfoot, and why make it up? Why do they need to make it up? They have far more to lose than they do to gain from fabricating a story. Credibility is everything. Christopher, my final question for you, because there's probably somebody out there who says, oh, great, another Bigfoot movie. Do we really need one of these? I obviously stand behind your work. Montauk Chronicles is a great movie, and I can only imagine what's ahead for Bigfoot, the movie. But for those who are still on the fence, tell them why yours is a little different.
It's okay. The best way I can explain it to you is I promise you that when you're done and while you're watching this, you'll realize that this is a perspective that you've never experienced. It's analogous to several other things, other pictures that have been made throughout history that before they were made, I guess if they were explained to you, you'd be like, well, that's just another drive-in movie, or that's just another this. But, you know, Dennis Hopper made a movie called Easy Rider in 1969. Before that, the biker genre was just a drive-in movie. It was like a Z-grade movie that no one would have ever thought there was this profound statement in this biker film. But there was, because nobody could have imagined it until Dennis Hopper imagined it and brought that out in the world. Same with George Romero when he made Night of the Living Dead. That was a statement on the race issues in the country at the time. And it became a very important film for those reasons, not just a horror film. But if he described this zombie movie to you back then, you'd be like, oh, it's just a drive-in movie, this horrible thing. And people still feel that way about it, some people. But the point being, I'm offering you a very unique, and I'm working very hard to construct this very unique perspective on this subject matter. And I promise you that it's something you cannot imagine right now, because it's my job to imagine it. So you're just going to have to wait and see, but I promise it's going to be worth the ride.
Christopher, you take care now. I'll be following the progress of the project and encourage my listeners to support it at GoFundMe.com/Bigfoot the movie. You take care now.
You too. Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Absolutely. That's Christopher Gerritano, MontaukChronicles.com, and again, GoFundMe.com/Bigfoot the movie. Yeah, I do believe in Bigfoot, and I always have believed in Bigfoot. Do you believe in the Tooth Fairy? Have you ever seen the Tooth Fairy? Do you believe in Santa Claus? Do you believe in the Easter Bunny? Do you believe in anything? Are you able to open your mind to the possibilities or the capabilities or to an alternate reality that, well, you can't necessarily always reach out and touch? Certainly on this program every week, I challenge you to think about the subjects that you hear on the program. Those that are worthy of pushback are given pushback, because I don't mind asking questions to get answers. I would much rather ask a hard question than come out of the interview wondering what if. So there is probably a thing called Bigfoot or Sasquatch or Skunk Ape or whatever name you want to use. Question is where, and question is when will there be definitive proof? For the reasons in which Christopher has outlined, and for the reasons in which many Bigfoot researchers have outlined, an incredible, I'm not sure what to call it, an incredible amount of smarts that these animals have in order to be able to detect their surroundings and to evade or elude ever being photographed, at least in an authentic way. And there's something to the fact that there are many people who go to state parks, who go to public places, and just flat out disappear. There's nothing to be found of them. It was as if they walked behind a tree and didn't come out the other side. In some cases, that is the reality. There's something out there that is snatching people up. Could it be Bigfoot? My mind is open to that. And the story of the Montauk Chronicles for ultimate mind control. Reverse engineering of alien technology. Have you thought about whether or not what is happening in our atmosphere with what many say are UFOs, our alien craft? I have a friend, Ken Fiverr. He's with MUFON, and he comes on the program regularly. He'll be on again August the 27th for his sightings report. But he makes no bones about calling them alien craft, because that's what he believes them to be. And I think the light bulb just went on. Because I'm going to ask him next time if this is what he really means. Because alien craft to me, or alien planet, or anything that's dubbed with that name, has me thinking, okay, well, they're obviously saying that's, if it's an alien planet, it's a planet where aliens exist. If it's an alien craft, it must be a craft that either extraterrestrials are driving, are navigating, or are somehow behind or built. By the way, we still have time left for you in the program tonight. 818-672-6865. You can Skype into Parabnormal, 818-672-6865. Because as I was saying there about what we believe things to be versus what they actually are, alien craft may just simply mean that these are craft of ours. They just happen to have alien technology in them. The light bulb just went on, friends. I don't know if you've been thinking about that all along. For the person who says, well, yeah, I have, call me. Let's have an honest conversation about that. 818-672-6865. But honestly, every time I have heard alien craft, I have thought one thing. Craft that are powered, manufactured, or in some capability directly tied to extraterrestrials. But what these might actually be is technology, whether it was in one of the meetings we talked about last week with Grant Cameron, meetings of presidents and extraterrestrials, whether it was involved in deals to trade alien technology for experimentations, maybe some of the like that we detailed tonight in the Montauk Chronicles, and others that countless people say they experienced as part of an abduction or as part of a visitation. I'm still interested in our caller from last week, who I'm kind of sad is not taking the time to call in now when we've had a few minutes at the end of the program, who told me that he was injected with gold. Injected with gold as part of a alien visitation. But see, it doesn't take much for me, ladies and gentlemen, to open my mind to the possibilities. And it shouldn't take much of you. Obviously, you're listening to this program because you believe that there might be something more to, you know, what we're being told. Next week on the program, it'll mark my second month back on the air, and I want to thank you for your support. My guests will be Kim Babcock and Aliza Metis, MD. She lost her son and now has afterlife contact with him. And her channeler is Kim Babcock, a medium, or psychic, however you prefer. Kim and Aliza will be here on the program 1 week from tonight. That's on August the 6th. Ufologist Peter Robbins will be here on August the 13th. And on August 20th, my guest will be Eugene Braxton as we talk about near-death experiences. And on August the 27th, in addition to Ken Pfeiffer's sightings report, Tom Pettit is going to come back to share some information about UFOs around nuclear sites. That has a history that you may or may not be aware of that we're going to delve into pretty heavily on the night of August the 27th. And as I mentioned last week, I'm going to be doing an additional show the last Sunday of every month starting in August because 2 hours, well, it's just not enough for me, and I know that it's not enough for you. You have demanded, so what you will get is exactly that. More of me. On the last weekend of the month, we'll be here both Saturday and Sunday nights. And to kick off my first Sunday night show, it'll be Preston Dennett talking ET and UFO encounters. And we're all booked up into September as well. Guests want to be on this program. They are flooding my inbox, and flood is a good thing. Until I talk to you next week, friends, I'm Jeremy Scott. From the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest, I bid you a good evening.